Welcome to the podcast of National Institute of Chemistry. You can relax and pour yourself a favorite drink from a nearby Erlenmeyer flask, Baker, cup, because the days of complex scientific reading are behind us. We are here to provide you with engaging and accessible explanations of the latest discoveries. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Gaspar Scholinz from the Department of Molecular Biology and Nanobiotechnology at the National Institute of Chemistry. We're going to look at how cryo-electron microscopy can help us study the structure of pore-forming proteins and what can it tell us about the role of lipids in the membranes. Hi, Gaspar.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being a guest and taking your time. First, I would love to start by asking you, how did you first get involved into the structural biology? What excites you about the structural biology?
So I actually got into structural biology more by chance than by design. I studied biology both in my bachelor's and master's. And during my master's thesis, I did lots of electrophysiology. So when I was looking for PhDs, I found this opening at our department where they studied nanopores and nanopore technologies. And most of nanopore technologies are done with a technique very similar to electrophysiology. So I just applied for the position. And it turns out that if you want to regulate your conductance properties of your nanopores, it's great to know their structure as well. So that's how I started doing structural biology. This was in the first year of my PhD in 2017. And at that time, we started doing X-ray crystallography, which is the gold standard technique in structural biology. It still is. But because pores are protein lipid complexes, membrane proteins, they're hard to crystallize. So luckily, at that time, in 2017, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded for the development of cryo-electron microscopy. So we, in 2018 and then later in 2019, when the Institute acquired our first and currently only cryo-electron microscope, we started doing cryo-EM as well. So we were quite early adopters We got into cryo-EM just when it was about to take off. Mm-hmm. And what's really exciting is how fast the method is developing. It started by being this low-resolution alternative for larger complexes. And now you can do high-resolution reconstructions of also small, but mostly still large proteins and other biomolecules in situ. So this development is really rapid, and it's really exciting where it's going.
It's a very nice method because in X-ray crystallography, you cannot probably see these big structures and the connection with, for example, like you did now with the proteins, lipids, and all together, it's only single protein molecules or some smaller complexes.
Not necessarily single, but yeah, like you said, large complexes tend to not form stable crystals, and especially things that move like lipids usually do, or disordered regions of proteins, don't form good quality crystals and you can't resolve their structures. With cryo-EM, you freeze them in their native state, and if they're there in sufficient numbers, you can then usually reconstruct them. So
for cryo-EM, you don't have to obtain the crystal, but you have to obtain the stable, for example, here, the pore or whatever molecules you are...
Yes, so there are several modalities of cryo-EM. What we use the most is called single particle analysis, where you have your solubilized sample, so purified protein or nucleic acid complex in water solution. You vitrify the sample and you then collect several thousands of images, and hopefully you get your complex in many copies, and from that you can do 3D reconstruction. There are other approaches. What's cryo-electron tomography is the second most commonly used modality, where you record a single tilt series. So you have your sample and you tilt it and view it under multiple angles, and from that you obtain three-dimensional information. And you can then do averaging of sub-tomograms, which then lead to high-resolution reconstructions. And this is what is used to image things inside cells, which is, I think, the most applicable for life sciences. But there's also a third use of cryo-EM, where you can do electron diffraction, which requires crystals. But that's mostly used for smaller molecules. But it works very similar to X-ray crystallography, but doesn't require large crystals. So you can do really small crystals.
Interesting. And I know some background about you because we were working a little bit of our time together in the lab. And I know that you're coming from biology, you're interested in nature, in caves, but also in volleyball. How does this all help you to be a scientist? And I can also imagine, you know, for me in my head, it's like caves. You go darkness, you see the things that you cannot see from the outside, cryo, electron microscopy, or solving 3D structures is similar. You cannot see them with your naked eye. And then, you know, is there any connection?
I never thought about this connection between caving and cryo-EM. It's just maybe that I like working in the dark and I'm not afraid of unknown places. But I always, since I was little, I like spending time in nature, and I always knew I was going to be a biologist, or I was going to study biology. And since I started working in the lab, maybe nature is just a way to relax and to clear my head. And yeah, the volleyball part. So I grew up in a team sport environment. And if you grew up in teams, whatever team sport environment, there's a real difference between people who say they're team players and people who just do things that benefit the team without thinking. So this is
interesting. Yeah. Also, I like the saying that you said that you like to work in dark places, because we have to mention that room where the cryo electron microscopy is. It's really dark, and
it has lights, but I prefer working with lights off.
Yeah, it has no window. It's protected from the outside
it's in the
noise
basement.
And shaking and everything, right?
Yeah.
So right. The work that you've done with cryo-EM proteins and lipids has been published in a very prestigious journal in Nature Communications, and is titled Cryo-EM Structures of Protein Pore Reveal a Cluster of Cholesterol Molecules and Diverse Roles of Membrane Lipids. And the expert opinion for this work was provided by Professor Kristina Sepcic, Head of Chair of Biochemistry and the Biotechnical Faculty, University of Ljubljana.
Proteini, ki tvorijo pore, imajo velik biotehnološki in medicinski potencial. Uporabljajo se na primer za sekvenciranje različnih bioloških polimerov, kot je DNA, kot bioinsekticidi ali kot sredstva za zatiranje določenih oblik raka. In seveda, če jih želimo uporabljati v te namene, je natančno poznavanje njihove strukture in interakcije z biološkimi membranami ključnega pomena. Gašparjevo delo obsega ravno te temeljne raziskave in predstavlja ogromen doprinos na področju. O vrednosti njegovih rezultatov pa priča tudi objava v vrhunski znanstveni reviji. Gašper je pokazal, da sta krioelektronska mikroskopija v kombinaciji s simulacijami molekulske dinamike nepogrešljivi orodji za tovrstne temeljne raziskave, ki odpirajo pod številnim morebitnim aplikacijam proteinskih tvorcev por.
Kristina, very nicely summed up your work. And I would like to ask you, what area of research does these studies relate to or have any potential applications?
So this study directly addresses the structure of a particular pore-forming protein. We discovered it and named it FAU after the organism it originates from. The most interesting part about this particular research is that together with the protein part itself, we were able to reconstruct a big chunk of the upper leaflet of the bilayer. So the way we prepare pores is we prepare them on artificial membranes, and then we solubilize them with detergents to disrupt the vesicle and to remove excess lipids. But even though this was solubilized and exposed to large concentrations of detergents, a big chunk of lipids still remained in complex with the pore itself. And we assigned different positions and roles to these lipids because Some of them are located deep in, between the two subunits of the pore and play major structural role in stabilizing the pore. There are some that are essential in membrane recognition. So pore-forming proteins are very interesting because they start their life cycle as water-soluble monomers. Then they recognize their specific target membrane, bind to it, oligomerize, and only then become a transmembrane protein. So some of the lipids were bound to this membrane recognition site and stayed bound to it even after the pore was formed and extracted from the membrane. We also describe a cluster of cholesterols, which has no specific interactions with the protein, but stays there and plays a huge role in filling in the spaces and stabilizing the other lipids. And also a group of lipids that has virtually no contact with the protein itself, but because the lipids surrounding the pore are so well ordered, they remain there. And they also help stabilize the protein itself, so the pore complex itself.
This is very interesting because you would think that lipids are like so easy to go away. They are so, let's say, soft or unimportant. Somehow we are thinking sometimes we really don't give them this big important role that they actually have. And now you prove that even with the strong detergents, they are just there and they stay there and have very important function, right?
Yeah, so the membrane is also, in the case of membrane proteins, the membrane is usually just looked at as a medium in which the membrane protein is located and not part of the membrane protein. And here we just show that, like you said, the lipids are usually very flexible. They move around, they diffuse freely in the membrane. But here, once they're close to the protein, some of them specifically bind to the protein, and also other are stabilized with non-specific hydrophobic interactions. So
why pore-forming proteins? Is there like any possible application of these proteins?
Yeah, there is a direct application. So also that I already mentioned this. So it's the method's called nanopore sensing, and it's based on you have a single pore in a non-conductive membrane, and you apply voltage across this membrane and measure current, ionic current running through the pore. And when some molecule gets close to the pore or passes through the pore, this changes the current. And from the characteristics of the current change, you gain information about the molecule passing through it. And this is most successfully utilized by nanopore sequencing, where a single strand of DNA or RNA passes through the pore, and you can get the DNA or RNA sequence out of this. And this is already commercially available, and it's developed by Oxford Nanopore Technologies. The company also funded some of this research.
Yeah, I found this method very nice because you can have, let's say, this machine or this small equipment in your lab, and you can sequence quickly your samples, because if you give the samples for the next generation sequencing, you have to prepare the samples, send them away, and it takes quite some time. So the pores are very applicable. But also probably, as far as I know, some proteins, pore-forming proteins, are also applicable for some medical applications. But probably the pore that you were researching is more into the nanopore sequencing.
Nanopore sensing. So the direct follow-up research that's still going on in this lab is the detection of different proteins. So we are currently unable to sequence proteins. The proteins are much more complex than nucleic acids. They're formed by amino acids that are 20 different amino acids that have all different sizes and charges. So unlike DNA, this is much harder to differentiate. It's also hard to unfold them. And so unfold your the protein you want to sequence and keep your pore pore folded. But so what we're doing right now is detecting whole proteins, histones, because they have the correct size and charge that matches the properties of our pore.
This will be amazing when we will be able to sense the proteins through the pore.
This is, I think, the final step.
Yeah. Let's hope we see it soon. So you mentioned some key motivations to understand the pore, to understand the lipids. Were there some other motivations that you had to conduct these experiments?
So there are more general pore-forming proteins are present in all domains of life because an understanding their mode of action is very important because some of them are also parts in arsenals of pathogenic bacteria. So there's always other motivations and just why to study except for biotechnological applications. That's the obvious answer you want to always state because you need the grant, but just the mechanism of pore formation itself is very interesting.
And understanding the membrane.
And understanding
because
it
the
membrane.
Can be applied to all the cells that we have.
Yeah, that's right. That's why it's the pore forming proteins are so widespread, is because membrane is the common point of all living cells. And it's a fairly direct way to harm whoever you want to harm. So you just develop something to disrupt their membrane and the cells, their cells die. So. Yeah, it's the first step to you can attack.
Yeah. So how was the overall research process? How did you start? Of course, you have to produce the proteins probably. And how does this go?
So we start by searching for new pore-forming proteins. This is now getting more and more complicated because there's more and more data available. In part also due to the development of nanopore sequencing technologies, there is now more and more genomes known, also metagenomic data. And from these publicly available sequences, we then try to predict what are new, to find new potential pore-forming proteins. We then order genes. We express them recombinantly, the proteins, mostly in E. coli. And then you have to purify the sample. You do some basic biochemical characterization. We test for hemolytic activity, which is the standard test for pore formation. And from that, you try to find the correct conditions under which the protein forms pores. And then comes the extraction and the stabilization in its soluble form. And then we go to cryo, which is my favorite method.
So once you have the protein, you have to put it in the environment where it can, where it will form pores, which is you prepare the system that is similar to the real cell, right? Or mimic the cell membrane, but really,
yeah,
in the simple way.
very simplified mimic of the cell membrane. The proteins that we work with the most are actinoporin or actinoporin-like proteins, and they bind directly to lipids in the membrane, so they don't require, unlike some other pore-forming proteins, they don't require protein receptors in the membrane. So it's quite easy to produce these membrane mimetic systems, but still you have to play with the lipid composition, and once you find it, then you can start with pore solubilization process, try to characterize it structurally.
So once you have the pores, you prepare the sample for cryo-EM. How is it in cryo-EM? Is there some special things you have to be careful about? Like
sample preparation for single particle analysis can be very robust. Mm-hmm. Your sample doesn't have to be as pure as in the case of X-ray crystallography, where you want to have as pure a sample as possible in order for it to crystallize and to get crystals of what you want. In cryo, even if only 50% of what's in your sample is your pore, you can still get a pretty decent structure. That's one of the benefits of cryo. Even if you just have your pore, but it has multiple, your sample doesn't necessarily have to be a pore, and it has multiple conformations, you can capture and resolve all of those conformations. So in this case, this aspect, it's quite robust, but there's always, as in all methods, something can always go wrong. The problem with protein pores is that they're membrane proteins and as such quite hydrophobic, so they get to stick to the carbon of the cryo-EM grid, and you don't want that. You want to have your sample in the holes in the carbon. So you have to have your sample in sufficiently high concentration to first saturate the carbon and then get. So there are always some optimization steps, and sometimes there's not much you can do except just try a bunch of stuff and hope for the best.
Once you require the images, probably there are hundreds of them.
Thousands, usually.
Thousands of them. And you have to by eye select, or are these already programs know how to select some?
Most steps, so most decision making is still done by humans. Mm. There are, of course, algorithms that can help with that. You can immediately recognize bad micrographs. So if the ice is too thick, if you have wrong kind of ice, so you what you want to have is vitrified ice and not crystalline ice. And if you don't have enough samples, so if you don't have enough sample in the image, you can by eye discard that. But it's hard to go through, well, not hard, but very time consuming to go through thousands of images by hand. So you usually just select them based on some criteria after some initial analysis of the micrographs. So you can recognize bad eyes from the CTF estimation, and there's softwares are getting better and better at predicting what is good, what is bad micrograph, and also there are more and more ways to quantify the quality of your of your micrographs, so your cryo-EM images, microscope images. And from that point on, you can even handpick so they're called particles, so individual images of your individual complex in the sample, or you can do automated picking and then generate templates and then use template picking. So there's several decision making steps that require your attention, but most of the computing part is done by the computer. So but it's a computationally very expensive method, and also what's commonly neglected is the amount of data you produce. So a data set of 4,000 images is 5 terabytes, and after you start analyzing it, you produce even more data. So it's not uncommon to have 20 terabytes of data for a single protein, or even more. It depends on how complex the sample is, and this then tends to add up quite fast.
Oh my, this is a lot of data, yeah. And has to be stored somewhere, not to be lost. And yeah, if you make any mistake, if you make any mistake later when solving the protein structure, going back, looking at all this, it's quite time consuming, right?
Yeah. So funny you should say that. So when I thought I was about to finish with my PhD, I noticed that, and I already had tens of structures, I noticed that something didn't add up. The reconstructions were great, but when I was analyzing the interactions between subunits, there weren't as many as you would expect. And I realized that one of the calibrations of our microscope was off by 4%. Producer guarantees that this is between 5%, so 4% error still isn't that horrible, but in my case, it masked the interactions that I would be able to see. So I had to recalibrate this and then reprocess some of the data. It's not as time consuming as going through all the analysis again, but it's one of the calibration effects the micrographs themselves. So it changes the properties of raw data. So you have to go through the process almost in its entirety.
Yeah, just skip the part of preparation of the sample.
Yeah,
but the rest
data you collect is completely fine. You just have to keep the calibration in mind, and then you reprocess most of it. So when I was about to finish, I found this out and then reprocessed most of the data. And so this was a minor hiccup at close to the end.
Yeah. What are some other, let's say, limitations or some problems at your work? Doing with pores, lipids, cryo-EM.
With pores, it's quite problematic to get them stable. They're membrane proteins, so they require a lipid environment. and it's not that straightforward to solubilize them and keep them happy in their aqueous buffer. So this is a tedious process that sometimes works great and sometimes you just find no solution to it. The way we first try doing things is we just solubilize the vesicles we use for pore preparation with detergents and then add detergents to the buffer and hope that our pores are happy enough so the detergents bind to the hydrophobic regions of the protein and then thus stabilize them. But there are other membrane mimetic systems that you can use, but each one of them is very time consuming and this is the hardest thing to optimize, I think. Mm.
Yeah, you mentioned time consuming. How long does it take to, let's say, to come to the end to write this kind of paper? Like from sample preparation, how long does it take to solve one structure after you have, for example, all the images?
So
it's difficult to say, right?
It's hard to say.
It's months and months and here and there going back to the lab, back to the computer and so on, right?
Just for in ideal case where you, from ordering your gene to collecting data on cryo, and so you order your gene, you clone it, you express your protein, you find the correct condition, you extract it, and this all goes without any hiccups. Before you get to the microscope, that's 2 to 3 months of work. From that point on, you collect the data pretty fast, unless you have to optimize the sample and it doesn't want to go, it's not nicely dispersed in the grids. Mm-hmm. Data collection takes a couple of days, and then the analysis, in our case, is pretty straightforward. I mean, the first time I did it, it took me a long time because it was also...
The learning process
is... It makes everything longer. But analysis, again, if all high-performance computer clusters work as they should and there's sufficient amount of storage space, it can be quite fast. So you can get your model from cryo-EM data to your atomic model of the pore within a month, maybe sooner.
Nice, yeah.
But then,
it's always more.
It's always more, and then you interpret the data and redo the experiments and alter some things and try again. Yeah. So that's why it sums up into years. So the first data set for this paper was recorded in 2018.
Oh my, yeah. Even the to publish the paper takes such a long
time. Also, the publishing process, it was more than half a year, I think, since we submitted paper and it went published with no major additional experiments or
So one thing that you brought with you is the 3D print of this pore, I suppose. It's interesting because it's octameric pore, we say, so it has these 8 monomers, right?
Eight the protein we study forms predominantly octameric pores, but we can also get nonameric and heptameric. So this means 7 and 9 subunits. The print here also has lipids on it. So if you look at the bottom part.
Oh, nice. Still attached like you had it in
yeah,
the
so
experiment.
It's quite easy to create 3D printable data sets from the volumes you get from cryo-EM. The software now just you can export it as STL or
the file that 3D printers
use, so you can directly print your molecules. Yeah,
very nice. And you also sent me the photo of you next to the cryo-EM, right?
Yeah. So the idea is that I usually look at pores with electron microscope, and the idea of the photo is a pore looking at me with a microscope.
So the pore is like a framing you with a microscope.
Yes, through the eyes of the pore.
Nice. So what were some main results, key findings that you obtained during your work?
Main result is the structure of the pore itself. This is then already been used as a scaffold for further development and optimization of the nanopore and its application in sensing applications. Lucky side effect was the role of lipids in the pore formation and in the structure of the final pore. And also with the help of some molecular dynamic simulations, we found that the effect of the pore on the membrane itself is quite large. So it's not just the lipids that we were able to solve for with cryo, and not just the lipids in contact with protein. This extends further to lipids that are not in direct contact with the protein, but have like several indirect interactions. So a lipid in contact with lipid in contact with protein is still affected by the presence of the protein. And this effect on the membrane, well, membrane lipids, was not the same in the upper and lower leaflet. So in the upper leaflet, the pore binds to the upper leaflet. So it has specific interactions in that part. It grabs on to lipids, and these lipids then order other lipids. And in the lower leaflet, there are no specific interactions between the protein and the membrane lipids, so this effect isn't as pronounced. So there's just the lipids in direct contact with the pore are slightly affected, and the rest show no
mm-hmm. So if the composition down of the lipids is different, then also the acting of the pore is different. So how it functions, or how it assembles, or how stable it is.
Yes, in a way, in this particular case, the protein itself is quite robust. It requires sphingomyelin to bind and to form pores. If sphingomyelin is not present, it can still sometimes bind to the membrane, but doesn't undergo the pore formation and oligomerization step. And what we discovered is that when cholesterol is present, which is not required for the pore formation itself, it stabilizes lipids around the pore, and in turn also stabilizes the pore itself. So once we solubilize the pore, the cholesterol stays there with other lipids, and the pore is more stable.
Mm-hmm. So this is also important later for sensing, yes, right? So you know in which conditions it's better to form the pore.
To get it in a more stable form, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So how do you see that these results will impact, what kind of impact will have on this field of structural biology or membrane biology?
It's hard to predict this, but with more and more cryo-EM structures of membrane proteins being published, there's a bigger emphasis on lipids. So we're not the first to see lipids in our structures. We're the first to describe them in such amount. So roughly a third of the atoms we placed were lipid atoms. So a third of the structure we reconstructed were lipids. Mm-hmm. This is quite significant because it's not such a small protein. It's not a single domain protein. So the amount of lipids is high. Lipids are not just the medium in which the proteins are located. They also have the role in the correct structure and in turn function. Sometimes they're required for correct functioning, even if the fold is correct. And there are several aspects of the membrane that are not were ignored, but not intentionally, just because we weren't able to characterize them before, but we can see them now. So this, I think, is going to get more attention over time, especially because of the advancements in cryo-electron microscopy, not just because of this paper, but...
So you emphasize this importance of lipids to encourage other researchers to conduct more experiments and include the lipids with their research, how important
they are. So do not just ignore them and see, we also see some unidentifiable density next to our protein parts. Sometimes those are very important for the correct function of the protein.
Gáspár, thank you for taking your time being the guest of this podcast and representing this important work that was done and introducing us also more closely to the cryon electron microscopy, which is quite new, let's say, comparing to other methods in structural biology. And yeah, I wish you all the best with your further research.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The guest of the 11th episode of the Papers Illuminated Člankarnica podcast was Gáspár Solinc. We encourage you to tune in again next month as we explore fresh insights from a new paper.